Awesome. So you got the spoons there. Do you have honeymoon suite as well?
No,
No.
that's also ELO.
Oh, are you going to the concert?
I don't know. I don't
All
know.
right.
I went to the last final ever show. So I missed the first final ever show. I was
Yeah.
able to see the second final ever show. So I'm not sure if I'm going to go see the last
Third.
final
Final
ever
show.
show.
Maybe Jeff Lynne is doing an Elton John final tour. Minaz and I went to Elton John's final show in Toronto,
Yep.
and he has since done, I think, three more.
Yep.
So that's the way it goes, man. Listen, we'd be remiss if we didn't do a quick concert review, Greg. Last, not this past WrestleMania weekend, but the weekend before, we went to see the Highwaymen of the Trans-Canada.
Type.
Yeah. The Trans-Canada Highwaymen concert at the Opera House in Toronto. What a fun show.
Was
Just a
great.
fun show. A lot of great hits, a lot of special guests. And yeah, how did you find the show?
Oh, I thought the show was great. I thought, the guys had a lot of fun. You're right. I mean, to have Tom Wilson come out and join them to do a
Yeah.
Junkhouse tune.
Yeah.
Bruce McCullough hosted. It was just, the fact that they, made fun of, not made fun of, but made fun of themselves and made fun of all of us and our ages and stuff, right?
Yes. They know their audience. They know their audience. And it ended on time. It ended nice and early. So we could
Well, we're all old. Once again, we're all old. So
yes.
it's like
Older. We're
nobody wants to be
older.
out after 10.
Yes, a great show, A plus show. If anyone has the opportunity to see the Trans-Canada Highwaymen, they're touring Canada. Check them out and check out their album Explosive Hits Volume 1. And if you listen to enough of that album, there will be a Volume 2. We've been promised. I think they promised at the show that there's a Volume 2. So looking forward to them playing again and releasing some new tunes, some cover tunes. Just a fun band. And that is the pre-show.
That is the pre-show.
Hello, I am Rob Pruse, and I am happy to be a guest on Welcome to the Music.
Welcome, 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 Rob. It is an honor and a privilege to have you on the show. I have to say, and I told this to Gordon Sandy when we had them on the show a year or so ago, you were my first real concert
Amazing.
at Iroquois Arena in Whitby.
Okay. So probably like 82, 83-ish.
Probably, and around there, around 82, 83. And I think back to that time, and it's funny because we had Ron Hawkins on just like last week and week before, from Lowest of Low. And he and I were sharing stories about playing Larry's Hideaway when we were
Oh,
like
yeah.
16 and 17 years old. So what I wanted to ask you about was, I think you were like 15 when you joined Spoons. Like, can you, like, what was that like? How did it come to be,
It was amazing. I loved playing Larry's Hideaway, actually, for like a weird grungy place. Whenever I'm on like Facebook pages for Larry's, because like when people talk about memories of it, and I always love seeing old photos, because like in my mind I can picture it, and I can picture the stage and like the terrible carpeting on the stage, right? And the big side, like the speakers and all the stuff, right? And the terrible dressing rooms, and yeah, like there were all those clubs in Toronto that you just, I mean, if you were around at that time, you just have those memories of what it was like, like,
Yeah.
But yeah, I joined the Spoons when I was 15. So the first gig I did was at the Edge with the band, mm-hmm. which is another great, you know, lost venue. It was, mm-hmm. it was a super cool place to play. And, we basically, like, we made the rounds because I was, when I joined the band and I was 15, I was in grade 11, I guess. And Gordon, Sandy, and Derek were finishing college and university. So we weren't doing a lot of gigs. Like, we spent a lot of time rehearsing. And then within the first few months that I was in the band, we started prepping to record the first album as well. So it was a pretty cool that it wasn't full time, but it was like there was a forward momentum happening with the band, you know, so I could go to school. And sometimes we'd be doing a gig and I'd get home late and maybe skip first period. But you know, able to finish grade 11, finish grade 12, because then by the time when grade 12 was finishing, Nova Heart had just been released. So So I went back for grade 13 for like 2 weeks, but then our album Aries and Symphonies was going to be released. And I was good. You know, we had already had these, like our first tour to go to the West Coast and stuff had been planned. So I was like, I don't think I'm going to go back for grade 13. So I sort of missed my grade 12 graduation, but I did get the diploma, you know, so that was cool.
That's awesome.
How do you, with that age gap, how do you hook up with the Spoons? How do you hook up with Gordon Sandy? Like where does a 15-year-old meet college people that are just about to graduate?
I knew of the band because so like I had been in bands in Burlington since I was 10 years old. Like I was in my first band when I was 10, and my best friend who lived across the street, he had a band. And so there was like this period of like 4 or 5 years where I was in a band with friends at age 10. And then the band would break up and a couple of us would go and join another band and I'd put another band together. And it's all just like, you know, local kids doing the stuff, yeah. Right?
Okay.
But then the friend of mine who lived a couple of doors down, actually it's his birthday today, his name is Mark, and his older brother was one of the managers of the Spoons. Like he and his best friend like knew the Spoons because they were from Aldershot, which was like the west end of Burlington. And I was getting into the new wave music and listening to, you know, whatever was coming from England. And, you know, like the Cars were a new thing. And I was obsessed with Gary Numan because I had a synthesizer since I was 11. My parents bought me a synth, so I never played sports. So instead of investing in hockey gear, I got a Roland synthesizer. So that was my thing, right? So I started hearing about this band, the Spoons, because it was like, oh my God, there's a local band that's this new wave band. How cool is that? And because my friend's older brother sort of had connections to the band, I heard a tape of them doing a gig in Toronto. And I would see the posters that they were making every time they were doing gigs. They put posters up all over Toronto and stuff. So I had this collection of the posters even. So the summer before I joined the band, I had my wall was plastered with Spoons posters, which is like so weird, you know, that I didn't really know the band, but I knew of the band. So it was like they had released one single. They had released this double-sided single. And so I knew that. And I met them briefly when XTC were playing in Hamilton. They played at Hamilton Place in the spring of 1980. And Gord and Sandy were there with their original keyboard player, who I sort of knew as well. So it's like it's all like local yokels, you know? Like it was all sort of interconnected, even though they were a little older. I had that one extra friendship connection that sort of tied me into their world. So they knew I was a keyboard player because that's the summer before I joined the band, I did a recording with their original keyboard player. It was the very first year that CFNY was doing their Great Ontario Talent Search. And it was like their version of the Q107 homegrown thing, right? Yeah. Summer of 1980. That's so weird. It's so long ago. But their original, so the Spoons' original keyboard player, Brett, came over to my place because I had an old reel-to-reel recorder that my uncle had given me. And we recorded a couple of songs. And Gord came over and played saxophone on this song. I was only 14. Like, it's just so bizarre. So then later that year, when Brett quit the band, they put an ad into the Hamilton Spectator looking for a keyboard player. And it's one of those things, like I still remember that moment coming home from school. And I would always read the classified section of the paper looking for the bands. There was, you know, small listing in the Spectator, but there was the little tiny ad says Spoons require keyboard player. And I was like on the couch. I was like, oh my God. So I called him up and he's like, I said, hey, it's Rob. And he vaguely knew who I was because he sort of remembered, you know? So yeah. I went and I auditioned for the band and then that sort of went from there. Crazy.
Wow, that's, That's very cool. That's very awesome. Cool. It's interesting. You mentioned New Wave, and you know, it's one of the questions that I wanted to ask you was, you know, spoons were New Wave, but early it was very progressive. Like it wasn't, and it may be because of the European influence. Can you talk about sort of that beginning sound and the, I wouldn't say prog rock, but it's very progressive.
For sure. Well, I think really like Gordon Sandy always talked about the fact that they were listening to more progressive music, like 70s kind of, like there was a band called Vandergraaf Generator and Gord loved Genesis and that kind of stuff. So I think their earlier incarnations before the Spoons were a little more experimental in that way, you know, with weird time signatures and stuff like that. And then when the New Wave stuff started happening, say like Talking Heads and XTC and stuff like that, it was a much more stripped down kind of angular sound. But I think that even the early New Wave came from an influence from progressive rock as well, but trying to move away from it. But they still had the inspiration and the influence of having heard it in the first place, right? So I think that's kind of where Gord was coming from. And then I came to the band with my synthesizer, inspired by Gary Newman and inspired by Gary Wright and anything that had basically anything that was electronic. Mind you, I also came from the world of Elton John and Queen and that stuff as well. But when I took a turn into the world of New Wave, I was looking for anything that had keyboards, anything that was electronic in that way, because that was the new frontier as well. So it's like the timing was perfect for all of us to kind of come together in that way. But like our early days, I always think of our first album, and the keyboard that I used, the only keyboard I used on the album, was the same keyboard that Nick Rhodes used on the first Duran Duran album, because it was sort of like in 1981, that was like an affordable synthesizer, but it could do a lot of things. And I remember listening to their first album, and theirs came out, I think, either just before, like within the month or two of our first album coming out too. And I remember listening to them thinking, oh, he's using all the same sounds I'm using. Like, it's really cool. You know, so we kind of both copied each other with the haircuts as well. We were sort of influenced by David Sylvian from Japan, and which was sort of influenced by Bowie. So, you know, all these things sort of happen organically in that way, where there's no real leader, but you just are all sort of, you're all kind of going down the same river at the same time with the inspirations, you know?
That's fascinating. What was the board?
It was a Roland Jupiter 4.
Jupiter 4. Okay.
Yep. Which I still have. My first synth that my parents bought for me when I was 11 was a Roland SH-2000, which was a monophonic synth. And I still have that as well. And then the Jupiter 4. So the first album I did completely with the Jupiter 4. I played a little acoustic piano on it as well. And then we had a little bit of Mellotron on a couple of tracks, but I didn't play that. We brought the guy who owned the Mellotron, played it. They were like, you're only 15. You don't know what to do with a Mellotron. We're not going to let you near it. So I got to just stand back and listen. Yeah.
That's funny, because I remember I played at my high school. I can't remember how old I was, but we played Planet Earth at one of our assemblies.
Yeah.
And I had to rent a Jupiter. I can't remember what the shop was in Ajax or whatever, the music shop there. But I went there, rented the Jupiter, because I had to have that to play in the school, in the gym.
Amazing.
Because of Nick, right?
So yeah. Well, it's amazing, like when you have that opportunity as a kid. Like when I was in one of my first bands, I guess it was before I even had an actual, before I got the synth and I had an electric piano as well. Before I had that, I was just playing on acoustic piano. Like in my first band when I was 11, we could only play wherever there was a piano. The drummer in my band, he had a big old upright piano in his basement. So I'd go over and he had his drum set up in the corner of the rec room in the basement, you know, big shag carpeting and all the jazz, right? 1976, it's crazy. But yeah. I would play that piano and it was so fun. Like it was so rewarding to just make the music. But I remember then when Queen released A Night at the Opera, and I was obsessed with that album, and You're My Best Friend had a Wurlitzer electric piano on it, right? And like, so my ears were just tuning into anything that sounded like a keyboard. And if it was electric, I was like, what is making that sound? So my dad took me to a music store in Hamilton and we rented an electric piano. And then it turned out that it was the wrong piano, because I didn't know, I didn't understand the difference between a Rhodes piano and a Wurlitzer piano. And the Rhodes was big and heavy with the suitcase bass, you know, the amplifier built into the suitcase and stuff. And we set it up, and the first thing I tried to play was You're My Best Friend. And I was like, no, it's not the right sound. But I realized, you know, you sort of learn as you go, but it's just so rewarding to have the equipment to recreate the sounds. Like you with the Jupiter, I'm sure it's like, there's nothing like it, right?
Yeah, 100%.
That's cool.
Yeah.
So Rob, you go from the Spoons, Yeah, you join Honeymoon Suite.
Yep.
And from Honeymoon Suite, you end up in Broadway.
So. Yeah, I guess not end up, but it was part of the journey.
No, sure. Yeah.
But yeah, journey, I know, right? What you mean. Yeah.
So I'm really curious, and you've also said this, that you're one of the most open-minded people in music, because you've touched different genres. You don't sort of stay, I'm going to stay in, you know, in new wave, or I'm going to stay in progressive.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you about all of these genres and what makes you almost like a musical chameleon in terms of being able to adapt and play different styles and to go into different directions when it comes to music.
I guess I just love all music. Like it's just because when I was a kid and I started piano lessons when I was five, and my teacher took me through the Royal Conservatory training with, you know, like learning all the technical stuff, learning the scales and all the, you know, I did harmony lessons. I did all that stuff. And I did my exams every year. And at the same time, I wanted to learn to play pop songs. And the first pop song that I wanted to learn when it was on the radio was The Entertainer by Scott Joplin, which is not really a pop song, but it was on the charts when that movie came out, The Sting. And it was so, yeah, so it was like early 70s, you know, like this was 1973 or 74. Like, that's how long ago is that? It's a long time ago. And I heard this, you know, solo piano on the radio, instrumental. And I thought, man, even at age six or seven or whatever I was, and I thought, wow, that's really cool. Like, I want to play that. So my mom got the sheet music for me and I practiced it and I learned it. And then I took it to my teacher and she said, oh, Robbie, that's too hard. Like, you know, we need to get you like a simplified sheet music version of it. Cause I probably didn't play it that well, but I tried really hard.
Yeah.
So I remember then going to the music store and getting the sheet music, which was the simplified version. And I remember right from the first time I tried to play it, thinking, this doesn't sound like it at all. Like it didn't sound the same to me. So I took it to my teacher and she was like, okay, that's pretty good. But she wasn't really interested in teaching me pop stuff. So what I ended up doing was that I would go to her for my classical. Then I would go home and I would get out my Elton John books and my Queen books. And I would get whatever pop songs from the radio I wanted to learn. And so I always felt like I had these two worlds happening at the same time, that I trusted my teacher to give me the basics. And I loved learning classical music. And I mean, I still love it to this day. Like, I can spend a whole afternoon, you know, just sitting at the piano and just like sight reading through classical stuff. But then I can also spend the afternoon on the synthesizer, just jamming around, whatever. Right. So I've always had both of those worlds going. And I guess the idea that I've always been open-minded is because I've loved like listening and playing all kinds of music. My dad played music. And so I always heard like crazy German music around the house when I was a kid, like Oompa-Pa music and Lawrence Welk. We'd watch Lawrence Welk and I learned to love that kind of music. And I love Disney music, like, you know, it, like, just the range of stuff. Like, as much as I loved rock and roll and I loved Kiss when I was a kid and I loved Queen and, you know, whatever, I think I've just stayed open-minded in terms of trying to be, and it's fun to learn any kind of music. Like, even for me now, like, my wife and I, we work with a lot of kids in our neighborhood and in our area with like, doing voice lessons and stuff, and kids come to us and they want to sing, like, the latest pop songs. And it's fun to, like, learn stuff that I'm like, I guess I wouldn't really choose to listen to it, but it's still fun to just be exposed to things and find the good things within it, you know?
Yeah, that's it's interesting because what you sparked something for me that I hadn't thought about in I don't know how many years, but my piano teacher and I did the, you know, conservatory all the way up.
Yeah,
she was really. Again, I got goosebumps. It just brought back this memory. It's flooding back to me. Like she was in tune with me that when she knew I was getting so frustrated,
yeah,
with the classical, she decided, okay, stop. At the end of the class, next week, I want you to bring some sheet music of what you want to learn. So I go
nice.
Like, you know, Boomtown Rats or something, right?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
That in. And we would spend, again, I'm just a blown away by the memory coming back here.
That's awesome.
We would spend just weeks and weeks just working on that piece. And
because and you know, the most important thing as a teacher, like what we discover with the kids that come to us, like I get frustrated sometimes with kids that we're teaching because they're not learning the basics, as far as like they're not learning to really read music and we're not teaching them like real musical fundamental, like rudiments of music, you know, but mm-hmm. what we're trying to instill in them is the love of music. And like mm-hmm. kids come to us because they want to sing songs. And when you get a kid who like has, they make a little, they'll write down a little list of the songs they want to sing. And then they come to us with a list. And then for me, the fun thing is to like, look for the sheet music. I'll go online and there's a couple of websites I go to. And what you want to do is just keep the kids inspired, you know, in that way. And otherwise you would stop. Like my parents never forced me to take lessons. And there were times I remember like only a few times in my childhood when if I didn't do my homework for my theory lesson and I would say, oh, I don't want to go to my lesson. And my mom would say, okay, well, you don't have to go if you don't want to go. You know, she would be like, sure, that's fine. Like we're not forcing you to go. And then I would turn around and say, okay, I'll go. Cause I really did like it at the end of the day. I did enjoy it. But you're right. Like the frustration, you should only make music because you want to make it, you know? And mm-hmm. I feel like I've been really fortunate to put myself into situations where I got to express myself and help other people express themselves and all of us together. Like, I feel like, you know, being with Gord and Sandy and Derek in the band and then being in Honeymoon Suite and then any musicals I've been a part of, there's a part of it that it's like the same for me in every situation. I treat it the same because I'm like, well, we're just making music and it's fun and we're trying to entertain people and we're trying to entertain ourselves and be creative and come up with something really good that we enjoy. And at the bottom line for all of it is that's the fundamental thing, is you're sharing something that makes you happy, you know?
Yep.
That's amazing. Cool.
Yeah. It's really fun.
You grow up, Rob, you grow up listening to Queen.
Yeah.
And then an opportunity comes up where you're asked to train someone.
I know.
To be Queen, Freddie Mercury. Like, how does that happen? And like, what goes through your mind and how was that experience? That must have been phenomenal working with Rami Malek.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was cool. I mean, it was just a couple of days that we spent together. So I had been doing this musical Mamma Mia, which, you know, was based on all the ABBA songs. And I did that show forever. I did it in Toronto. And then this is the reason I moved to New York, yeah, was to do the show here as well. So one of my original colleagues from London recommended me for the Bohemian Rhapsody project because they needed somebody who was in New York. It was like a cryptic email. They said, well, you know, there's a film project and there's an actor who needs piano lessons. And if you're interested, then let me know. And I was like, of course, I won't say no, because I didn't know anything about what it was going to be.
Okay.
But I just thought, oh yeah, I'll say yes, because like, why not? Like, it's a new opportunity, whatever it is. Then, you know, in the back of my mind, I'm like a little bit nervous too, thinking, I don't know if I'm going to be able to teach or do whatever I need to do, but I won't know until I say yes. So then the next email that comes, it's got some sheet music and it's got We Are the Champions and it's got Bohemian Rhapsody. And I'm like, oh, I guess I can. And then they had just started talking about the fact that Rami Malek was going to be doing this film. Like a couple months earlier, he had been on TV doing some interviews talking about it.
Yeah.
And so I thought, well, this is really cool. Like, what a cool opportunity this is. So then I had to arrange with his manager that he was in New York filming this TV show called Mr. Robot.
That's right.
And so we scheduled some time to get together. And basically, I was like his first piano teacher before he went to London to start doing the film. And so we got together in a rehearsal studio for a couple of days. And again, I like had to sort of assess him and figure out what he was capable of doing and what he would be capable of doing. And he wasn't a piano player at all. So basically,
wow,
I kind of tried to show him what it was kind of going to have to look like, sort of to fake it, you know? Mm-hmm. And I said to him, well, here's some important things. Like, the first time I ever saw Freddie playing Bohemian Rhapsody, he always did this crossover thing in the verses, in the octaves, right? In the verses of Bohemian Rhapsody. So I said, for sure, they're going to want to film your hands doing this, so you'll need to know this. So he stood over top of me and like filmed my hands. Like, he got on the piano bench and I sort of played, and he had a little video on his phone of me playing. And that was it. So then it was just a couple of days together. And then like a year later, the film comes out. And I thought, okay, well, that was really cool. And so my wife and I, we went to see the film, and I thought, well, I don't even know if I'll like have my name in the film or whatever, but I got a credit at the end as a piano coach. There was like five different people, you know, because then he went to London.
Yeah.
And there were people on the set with him to make sure to watch, to make sure things looked realistic, what he was doing and stuff.
Yeah.
But I was sort of honored thinking, oh, I'm like the first one to get to show you this stuff. And I got to tell him, like I said, you know, you're like representing Freddie Mercury in a way that means so much to musicians and Queen fans. But I said, for me as a musician, he was one of my inspirations, like as a piano player, because I would listen to those Queen records and just, I would get the sheet music and just want to play all their songs, you know? So it was really cool.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it was neat.
One of the things, and it's funny, when I learned that you were involved was because of your, not that I'm creeping you on Facebook, but you shared on Facebook something like, okay, now I can tell the world or something.
Well, it was like a year later because, So when I was with him in the studio, I was like, we got to take a picture together. So I took a picture of the two of us. And then I realized, oh, I think that there's like a non-disclosure, like you're supposed to sign an NDA for the film, whatever. So I sort of held on to it until it was like a year later when the film was being released. And then I had seen some other people posting about how they were involved with the film. And I thought, okay, screw it. Now I can mention it, you know, so now I can say something about it. So then I posted the picture and I said, well, I'm really proud that I've, and honored that I was a part of, you know, a small, tiny part of, you know, helping him do this thing. So then it was really exciting to do it. Yeah.
Yeah.
To share, the news.
Yeah, it was actually our mutual friend Earl Jive who shared your post, which is why I saw it.
Yeah.
And speaking of Earl, like I know, you know, Earl was on in the video for Telling the Lies. Actually, I'd completely forgotten Ash Slash was the mom in it. But anyway.
Yeah.
One of the things I wanted to ask you was if you could talk about the support that the Spirit Radio and CFNY gave and how it was important back then for not just Spoons, but also other musicians that were coming up at that time.
Oh yeah. I mean, that's like, it's so weird to think of the world that we live in now where everything is accessible all the time. Right. Mm-hmm. So in those days once you knew that there was like this new music scene happening with these new wave bands, true of the punk scene coming, you know, from, I guess it's coming from the late 70s. I mean, I guess I didn't really tune into it until probably like 79. Now I'm looking at, like, sometimes I think of the trajectory and the timeline of the music in my life. And I think it all happened in a real short period of time before I joined the Spoons, but it felt like a lifetime because there were such huge changes in the styles of music, you know, like say 77, 78, when I was 11 or 12, I was listening to Queen and Elton John and Kiss, and then I was in a band that was a little more progressive, and we were playing, like, we would play music from Styx and Genesis, and then somebody would slip in a Blondie song, and I was like, oh, this is kind of cool, what's this Blondie song? And then I would go to the Battle of the Bands, and my band were playing Kansas songs, and we were playing like songs by Sweet, Love Is Like Oxygen, because it had great keyboards, right? And then there was a guy in another band playing the Cars, and I was like, what the hell is this music? So then, you know, it's all shifting, but it's happening like in a small corner of the bigger picture of it all, right? But if you wanted to hear it on the radio, Chum FM and Q107 were playing still pretty mainstream from the last, you know, 10 years or whatever. And we discovered that CFNY was the place to go, because CFNY was playing progressive music, but then they were playing the new music coming from England as well. So I would tune into it, and it felt like you were in like a private club in a way, in that way. Mm-hmm. So it was just the place to be, really, like, you know, listening to Marsden. And it's weird because I think there were so many of us, like, whether it's musicians or just fans of music at the same time, we all were listening to the same stuff at that time, you know, because I talk to like Spoons fans these days, like I see people online as well. And anytime we talk about memories of specific things in our lives, I'm like, we were all listening to the same thing because there was really only that one station to tune into, other than college stations and university stations, which, you know, they had a smaller reach, but CFNY was the main source for all of us. So I think about like the time before I was in the Spoons, I was listening to it. Like I said before I joined the band, CFNY was doing a talent search, and I was doing a song to submit to the contest as well. And then once I joined the Spoons, we were still listening. One of the first, in fact, I think the first radio interview we did was for CFNY when our first album came out. And it was the first interview that Gordon and I ever did for the radio was a CFNY show. And we were so excited. We were like, holy shit, we're going to be on CFNY. Like, this is the coolest thing ever.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So Marsden was a huge champion because we were a local band and there weren't that many bands that were making music that he could, I mean, he would play whatever he got, of course, because just trying to like keep it local and keep it Canadian to the degree that you can. But there was something, I guess, in our music that Marsden really connected with as well. So we were really fortunate that he was a good champion of ours as well.
That's awesome. Rob, I love your stories. And I'm going to ask you for another one. We have a segment called Lost Venues, where we explore venues that don't exist that maybe you've played before and you've got a horror story, a funny story. Wondering if you have a lost venue in mind, Rob.
Well, it's funny that like, first, like I would practically say, like, when you Greg, you mentioned Larry's Hideaway, and I would think practically like any venue in Toronto from the olden days would be like a beautiful lost venue. And you know, you could do a little tour of the places that we played. Like, there was a place called the Cabana Room, which was a tiny little room upstairs in this little hotel on Spadina. Yep. There was
the Izzy.
Isabella? The Hotel Isabella. Oh my God. The stage was so small that like Derek and I would set up on the little riser, and Gordon and Sandy were on the floor. And then there was a friend of ours on the side of the stage, like with a little foot pedal changing the lights, you know, it was crazy. And Larry's Hideaway, there was the Edge, which is where I did my first Spoons gig. All those places. Yeah. Like, it's crazy. Like, and then we would play the universities, like at U of T, there was a place called, the Downstairs John was a place maybe at McMaster University in Hamilton. There was a place called The Spoke at Western University in London. But, you know, and The Chooch was a club in Guelph. So, like, my lost venue choices would be, those venues. Because I don't know that kids even go to music, like, that kind of opportunity even exists for kids these days, you know? If you're in school, I don't know how much live music they're even getting out to see. Like, hopefully they're seeing some. But, you know, for us, we would go to where the crowds were. So it was super exciting.
Yeah, I think it's up to parents like us to take them.
I know, exactly. That's right. Oh my God. And then we did the whole high school circuit. Like, you know, once we had success on the radio and stuff, like, we would play Ontario Place. And of course, there's another great lost venue, because that place was magical to play. But we did like the high school circuits of Southern Ontario, like literally every high school that was between Niagara Falls and like Ottawa or towards Montreal as well. Like, it seemed like that was a circuit for a band to play. And it was fun because the kids couldn't get to see us in clubs, and we couldn't, you know, we would be limited to the shows we would do at Ontario Place or Kingswood or those kind of venues as well. So we played Kingswood was another great place. Yeah. So like, there's so many.
Yeah.
Wow. I don't even know, Greg, if they have bands going through high schools anymore in Southern Ontario in the GTA.
We used to have Teenage Head come to our school,
exactly, you know, yeah,
kind of like, wow.
I think the year that I started grade 9, I think Max Webster played, and I have a, like a vague memory that I don't know if I saw them, but I probably did, because I remember I had this really vivid memory walking home with a friend of mine one day for lunch, and we were talking about Kim Mitchell, and we're saying, yeah man, he's so old, he's like almost 30. You know, when you're like 13 or 14 or 15, that's like an old man, you know. And I think, oh my God, like, now if you knew what you knew then, it's crazy. And the Kings were another band, you know, I saw them play, and then like within the year we were with the Spoons, we were opening for them as well, doing gigs too. So that was really cool.
That's awesome. So Rob, one of the questions I'd like to ask before we wrap it up is, what are you listening to lately? What's in your earbuds or your headphones or whatever you're listening on that people should check out? New, old, whatever. What are you listening to lately?
Oh, I listen to a little bit of everything. I'm a little bit of a Taylor Swift fan in some ways, because I feel like I'm trying to keep up with the kids. The kids love her so much. I was very excited to see her Eras film last summer. And I thought, you know, you can't deny it. Like, there's a certain element to pop music that people always say, oh yeah, the older generation doesn't get the kids. And I think it's true of every step along the way. And certainly there are elements of composition and recording technology that I think are not as good as what things used to be in the olden days, when everything was groundbreaking and everything was new. But I have to appreciate and admire the things that people are doing. And I think Taylor Swift is a fantastic songwriter. I think she's a great lyricist. she works with great collaborators. She's got Jack Antonoff as a producer. She works with really cool people, you know? So I listened to her with an open ear and an open mind, because you sort of can't deny it. And then I'll hear kids telling me that they love K-pop, and I'm like, what the hell is K-pop? And then I listen to it, and like, there's bands like BTS, and I listen to them, and I think, you know, I'm not a fan of hip hop and like rap kind of stuff, but you can't ignore it. You know what I mean? Like, so I'll tune into some of that stuff, and I can appreciate the technological elements of it. And then I think, yeah, there's some really cool stuff, because they do some cool collaborations. And then I go backwards and I listen to, there's a band from, I think they're from Australia, called Tame Impala, who I love.
Yeah, huge.
Right. And I saw them. Did I see them? No, wait. I saw Beck last summer with, maybe it was Tame Impala. No, there was another band that he played with. But you know, I try to listen to everything. It's the problem of being open-minded is like, I can never think of anything when somebody says, what are you listening to now? There's a new band, a brother and sister group called Lawrence, who I really like. They do really fun music.
Are you
going
to see them when they're coming into town?
I don't know when they're coming.
They're in New York.
Sorry, yeah. Right. Are they coming to Toronto?
Yeah, we're seeing them. My son was just asking me about it on the weekend. He's like,
oh, really?
Tickets to Lawrence, right? And I'm like, and then he looked up, and yeah, I can't remember when it is, but I think.
Are you going to go see them? No way. That's amazing. Oh yeah. I mean, they're fantastic musicians. Like, they're super cool. Yeah. And they have a couple of videos. Like, I don't remember the first video. I saw one video of them singing in a studio with a whole bunch of friends. And I'm amazed at like the musicality of these kids, you know, like the stuff that they're doing, it's really advanced. Like, it's sometimes it sounds a little bit like 70s, 80s ish as well. But they bring it to the new generations. Like, you know, as much as I think, well, you know, we made great music 40 years ago, the kids will look back and they'll see where their music comes from. But I don't think they're going to stay stuck in the music from the olden eras as well. They want to keep up with the modern stuff. So it's fun to go back and forth with it all. You know, I'm a huge fan of my Spotify playlists, because they'll give me random suggestions and things, and they'll mix up the old and new stuff. And I'm always discovering new stuff, even if it's old stuff. You know, I love that.
Yeah, that's awesome.
That is awesome. Rob, what are you up to these days? What takes up your time musically?
Musically? Well, like I said before, my wife and I are doing a lot of work here in Queens. We train a lot of kids, like for schools. There's a whole routine with kids that go to high schools and colleges where they audition to get into the schools, and they have to prepare music, and you know, there's a whole thing that they have to go through. So we do a lot of that kind of stuff. Training kids, singing. I do some work with some bands up in Canada still. There's a band from Ottawa called Church of Trees that I've been involved with for the last 5 or 6 years, doing remixes for them and mixes. Last year I did some solo gigs. I, for the first time ever in my whole life, I did some gigs up in Oakville and in Toronto. I played the Elva Combo last summer.
Yeah.
And it was sort of dipping my toes into the world of like solo kind of stuff. You know, like I wasn't me really alone, because I wanted to bring some friends with me. So I had some singers joining me doing different songs, and Sandy Horn joined me, you know, playing some Old Spoons tunes. And I want to do more solo shows in the future as well. But in the meantime, my current goal is like some more recordings as well. Like, I need to do some solo music to release, to sort of have people able to listen to stuff online as well. So it's nice to remember the old stuff. But I feel like I also want to do some new music as well. So I'm sort of investigating different ideas these days to sort of hopefully release something in the next few months.
As you're speaking and everything, I'm like, there's a book. Has Rob written a book that I don't know about? Is Rob writing a book?
I'm not yet. I've been taking notes for what I would call a book, I guess, because I feel like I do. I've done a lot of like interview kind of things, sort of talking about stories and things. And I feel like, I could put them into some kind of a format as a book. And I think, you know, Gord released a book like eight or nine years ago, I think, sort of telling the Spoons journey. And I loved reading his book, because it was fun to sort of go, oh, I sort of forgot about these things. And, you know, his version of the story that we've been through. Yeah. And so it does occur to me sometimes to like maybe do it in that way as well. So you never know. Yeah. Part of what I was trying to do actually with my solo shows, it was a little bit autobiographical because of what I wanted to do was really span the journey of the music that I love. So I was playing like Spoon's tunes and Honeymoon Suite songs. And then I did some songs from show, like the musicals that I've been involved with as well, whether they were Andrew Lloyd Webber musicals or if it was Mamma Mia songs. And then I would just do songs I love too, you know, because there's just like this crazy variety of stuff that I like. So I feel in a way it's kind of, I think it's cool that I'm interested in so many styles, but at the same time, sometimes it's easier if you're just like an old rock and roller who's like, man, I play rock and roll and that's what I do. That's the only thing I do. And then you know where to put a person, you know? I'm sort of like, I'm all over the place.
Which is fantastic, right? Because you'll have multiple stories from different areas that I find that fascinating. Rather than, you know, the same old rock and roll journey, you know, it's a musical journey that takes you to different places, to different musical genres. It's almost like a musical Forrest Gump.
It's true. Well, yeah, it's true. Yeah. Because I do feel like when I made the switch into musical theater, it was like a clean break in a way that I was with the Spoons for 5 years and I was with Honeymoon Suite for like about 3 years or so. But within that span of time, I laid the groundwork for music that means a lot to a lot of people, like, you know, making records that still people still resonates with people, you know, in that way. Like, that's the music that people think of when they think of the bands I was in. They're like, well, he was in the Spoons, he was in Honeymoon Suite. But then I guess for that next chunk of the music that I made, it was really like live music. It was musical theater where 8 shows a week, I'm like sitting in a pit playing a piano or conducting the show. But it's like you're recreating music every night. Like part of the coolest thing for me to do the musical Mamma Mia was to sort of bring those worlds together, because I was in different musicals in Toronto for about 10 years before I started Mamma Mia. And then with Mamma Mia, the guys from ABBA, Benny and Bjorn, they really wanted to stay true to the sound of their music and the sound of their records. And so it was like the perfect marriage for me to get into that show when they were first, when we started the show in Toronto, it was the first production outside of London. And they were still even a little bit unsure of whether the show was even going to become anything outside of the UK, because they thought, well, maybe like ABBA were super huge in London and in England, and they thought, well, maybe the show is not going to translate anywhere else. So when they came to Toronto, we got to be a part of that first, well, it was the second production in the world, really, that became what they would consider the international version. So I got to be there with them and sort of help them and sort of make suggestions for the arrangements to say, it'll sound more like the record if you do this, you know, and like help with some of that kind of stuff as well. But it really brought all those elements of my life together in that way. So that was, I feel really fortunate to have been a part of that, you know, that it was like the rock and roll history that I had creating songs with the Spoons and with Honeymoon Suite, I got to take to ABBA. Like, one of the first songs I played when I was a kid, I was Mamma Mia. When I was 10 years old, I have a recording of myself playing it.
Oh my,
in my band. So to go and do the show with Benny and Bjorn all those years later, it was like this weird, you know, like full circle life kind of thing. Circle of life.
That's interesting. One of the things I wanted to ask about, and it's actually a two-part question. So, you know, how different were things? And again, you know, Ron Hawkins and I were talking about sort of all the various genres and, you know, how our fans, like New Wave, wouldn't understand how we're hanging out with the metalheads, and the metalheads fans wouldn't, you know, but to us, we were all just musicians, right? So, like, what was that experience from Spoons into Honeymoon Suite? Like, how did that differ? And then I guess the second part of the question is then the transition into musicals. I mean,
crazy, right? I know. Like for me now, of course, everything gets blended together and it becomes like a big soup. But in those days, it was like newsworthy. I remember there were little articles, even like in the Toronto Sun, there was a little blurb saying, ooh, new wave, Rob Pruse has joined Honeymoon Suite now. And like, it was because in those days, the genres weren't quite, things were more divided, right? Like, definitely Q107 was a place for Honeymoon Suite, but you wouldn't hear Honeymoon Suite on CFNY at all, right? So it for me, it was definitely a natural transition because I had been out of the Spoons for a little while before I joined Honeymoon Suite, and I was open to anything. And I remember, like, there was like a transitional time when with the Spoons we were on the radio with like Tell No Lies or Romantic Traffic, and Honeymoon Sweet were going up the charts with New Girl Now, and it was right around that same time, like 1985 ish, right? And so the next year after I left the Spoons, when I got the call to audition for Honeymoon Sweet, I remember thinking, oh, that might be really cool, because I mean, I remembered back to when I was a kid and how much I loved Kiss and how much I loved Queen and I loved guitars, and I would be in my band trying to play Kiss songs on the keyboard, and I was like the rhythm guitar player in the band, you know? And I thought, well, this will be fun, like, because Ray, the original keyboard player in Honeymoon Sweet, he was playing really cool synth parts as well. He was taking sort of the inspiration from the new wave era and the synth pop era and bringing that into the rock and roll, which was, you know, that was the next transition in the 80s rock era as well, because then that kind of, you know, went on with Journey and Bon Jovi, and we were all with Honeymoon Sweet, that was that sound then that was moving on. So for me, it felt like a natural progression. For the outside world, they were like, ooh, it's Rob from the Spoons and now he's in Honeymoon Sweet. But I, you know, for me, it was really fun. It was like an exciting thing. And then similarly, going after being in Honeymoon Sweet, going into the world of musical theater, for me, it felt natural, because I thought, well, when I was a kid, I learned how to read music, and to go into the pit, I don't need to bring anything else but my brain and my technical abilities, and I can go and sit at the piano and play. But there was a whole thing on CBC, like they came into the pit at the Pantages when Phantom was first opened, and they were like, Rob Cruise has gone from the stage to the pits. And it was like this little news segment. And it was like, I think now, like, wow, it must have been really slow news times, you know, to like think that was, it was newsworthy for them. But, you know, I think, well, it was 1989. So it was still really like the 80s world was happening, you know, so that's trying to cover things happening in that way. Yeah.
Listen, this in music these days, there's a lot of talk about artificial intelligence. And the ability for these computer systems and programs to be able to take styles from different places, voices, sounds, and put it together to create new music,
yeah,
or to even mimic artists. What are your thoughts on AI in pop music, and is there a place for it? Is it something to keep an eye on?
I think the whole idea of AI in so many ways is very strange still. I think we're all still trying to understand what the heck it is, you know? Like, the first time that I heard people like taking the elements of a voice and mimicking it to do another song, there's like a couple of YouTube channels where there's a guy doing, well, I'm going to take Freddie Mercury's voice and he's going to sing Beatles songs now, or I'm going to take Billy Joel's voice and he's going to do Elvis Presley songs or whatever. And for the first time you hear it, it's sort of unique and you think, wow, that's weird, because it does kind of sound like Freddie Mercury singing a Beatles song or whatever. But at the same time, it's kind of bad, because like it still sounds like the Beatles song, but with a sort of weirdly, vaguely Freddie Mercury kind of voice. So I guess it's sort of like an experiment, like a challenge, just because you can. But I don't know that that's a way forward creatively, because that ultimately is not going to create music that people are going to really want to listen to, other than just mimicking what's gone before, you know? So yeah, I think that there are things that it can serve. It can serve purposes. I heard the coolest thing, I heard somebody describe AI as a word processor. As it's a functional device that you can use, but you have to bring your own brain and your own ideas to it. So it's just a tool. And
yes,
a tool is only as good as the user. So like, people make jokes about writers where there's like, people go to see a writer being interviewed or a writer speaking, and they'll say, what kind of pencil do you use? Like, you know, as if knowing the kind of pencil is going to make a difference in your creativity. But it's actually not the pencil. It's not the tools. It's the inspiration, where it's the people that you are inspired by and what you take to go forward. And I think the world of AI is we're at a weird transitional time, because people can type a few words into an image generator and come up with pictures, but all the pictures are sort of weird looking and they're a little generic looking, and there's not a lot of originality to it. And like, I don't think the point of art is just simplifying it. I don't think the point is just to make it easier to do, you know? Part of the struggle is to like sit alone with your ideas and with your thoughts and work it out and have a lot of like a lot of rough copies of things and then get past that and come up with the final version. Like I went that last summer, they did a big auction at Christie's, did a big auction of Freddie Mercury's entire personal belongings. I don't know if you saw this last summer. They, his partner, Mary Austin, she was like the executor of his estate, and they kept his house completely pristine. They didn't touch it for 30 years. And finally they went in and they gathered everything and they sold it for charity and they sold it all at auction. And there were like sheets of paper with him like working on the Bohemian Rhapsody lyrics and like writing out harmonies for We Are the Champions and stuff. And you see him like scribbling out ideas and trying different things. And I think this is how creativity works. Like you have to like use your own thoughts and you have to like scratch things out and work through it, you know, and you can't just press buttons and do things. And there's a certain element to the technology to help us. But at the end of the day, you still have to trust your own intuition and your own ideas. So I think that the AI thing, I think we should all look at it as a tool, but it gets boring really fast. Like that's the other part of it. You know, like I think you can even start to recognize it when you hear or read certain things. You're like, oh, I think that doesn't sound like a person actually writing these things or making this music, you know? So
yes.
It's not going to go away, but I think we're still like in an embryonic stage to it all. So I think it's sort of fascinating, like in a way, like it's easy to dismiss it. Like we should be able to say that sounds like shit or that I don't want to, you know, look at that. I don't care. It's lazy. But at the same time, if you see something good, you should say, well, that's really cool. You know,
it's interesting. And it's sort of along the same lines when it comes to technology. One of the things, so in our discussion so far, we've talked about the importance of CFNY, Spirit of Radio, back in the day. And we also talked about how great it is to have Spotify and tools like that and Apple start to curate your playlist where you're going to learn stuff from.
Yeah.
I'd love to know your thoughts on, you know, as a musician who grew up with that support of radio to today, what are your thoughts on the impact of streaming services? And
it's weird. I mean, like there's so much good to it. I think the good outweighs the bad in many ways, which a lot of musicians wouldn't say, because a lot of people say, well, they're not paying enough money. And you know, it's fractions of a penny for the streams, which I think is true. But I don't think that the point of making music in the first place was ever, I mean, speaking for myself, I never made music to get rich and famous, and I never got really rich and never got really famous, you know? So clearly there were ulterior motives to me to making music, and it felt really good to play the piano and to make songs and meet people and have people say, oh my God, I love your songs. And I could say, wow, that's weird. Thanks. You know, so making money, making a living, making music is still like a weird kind of a gift. And it's a struggle sometimes too, but what are you going to do? You know, I'm not a lawyer and I didn't go to school to learn to do anything that's going to make me a lot of money. So it's fine. So the fact that people complain about the money that's not being made, or that's, you know, record companies have always been the people who made the most money because they're business people. And that's like their job. I signed contracts when I was a kid thinking, I don't know. I don't really know what I'm signing, and maybe I shouldn't sign it, but here I go. And all these years later, sometimes I think, oh, I probably shouldn't have signed that thing, but I did. So what are you going to do? You know?
Yeah.
So I think as long as people continue to want to make music and upload their music and share their music, there's a place to play music. And like we were talking about that band Lawrence, and I'm like, I don't know anything about their deals and what they're making and what they do. All I know is that they have thousands and thousands of kids who love them and want to go see them. Probably they go and buy a t-shirt. They probably make way more money selling a t-shirt than they do getting played on Spotify or whatever, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think that we all just need to embrace the technology, and things shift. And like, you know, if enough people are fighting for higher rates and royalty rates and whatever, that'll happen. But it's not going to stop the music makers. The music makers are going to make the music no matter what. And they should. We should be willing to just make it and say, you can't say, well, I'm not making any music because I'm not going to make any money. Well, yeah, that is true. But clearly you would have known that when you were younger, because you would have become something else. You would have done something else. You know,
yep.
I feel like making music, this is sort of the reason that I want to like have some music of my own to share online now as well, because I'm like, if I type my name into Spotify, nothing, well, things, there are some things that come up. I was involved with Spoon Songs and Honeymoon Sweet Songs, and this, there's musicals that I've been a part of, you know, that I've, I can see stuff come up on there, but I'm like, there's no actual original music of mine. So that's sort of like, I feel like for me, that's the thing that I want to rectify and do that for that reason, because I don't care about making money doing it. It just feels like that's what you're supposed to do. And I love the fact that the robots recommend music to me, the Spotify playlists, you know, every day there's a thing called Daylist, and it changes it like every 4 hours or whatever, it comes up with some new playlist. And I guess, you know, in the old days, you would trust a guy at CFNY, or you'd have your favorite DJs. We talked about Earl Jive. To this day, I'll take Earl Jive's recommendations and listen to the music he thinks is good. He stays really in tune with music that I'm way unconnected with.
Like, oh, his top list every week is like fantastic. I
but you know, well, the coolest thing with Earl is like, he's been a huge BTS fan forever. And like, you know, he's
make a joke about that.
He's an old, he's such an old dude, right? And I'm like, Earl, what are you, he's pushing BTS. But you know what it is? It's because he knows, he was there with the Beatles when he was 17 years old.
Yeah.
He was backstage at the Hollywood Bowl with the Beatles, right? Like, and he tells me these stories, and I'm like, it freaks me out to know that he's crossed, he's another like Forrest Gump in the music world, right? Really. So he looks at the audience and what the music means to the kids, and he understands that the music speaks to the kids, and no matter what the old people say, the kids don't care. It doesn't matter. So when there's a billion BTS fans around the world, no matter how bad anybody else thinks it is, the kids don't care, you know? And I think Earl has always had that ability to sort of tap into that world and stay open to the honesty that music means to people, which I think is really cool.
It's funny you said about BTS, because I was going to joke earlier saying I swear he must have been an early investor in the band, because
you think so, right? I know, it's really true. But I think he and I, that's, I think, you know, we've been friends since I was 17 years old. Like the first times we ever went to CFNY for promoting our records, and then he and Beverly would be like, hey, come and spin some records, and we would hang out together, and we had our love of music just kept us, we were like instant friends, you know.
Yeah.
And I feel like he, because of the world that he came through, he had that same kind of inspiration where he just knew that it was all about the music. And that's the driving force for every generation along the way. That's what keeps you going, is that love of something new. And, you know, he pushes, I don't even have enough energy to listen to all the new music that he's promoting. And like, he has his chart where he scans the charts around the world and stuff. And I'll tune into him once in a while, and sometimes he'll be like, oh yeah, I had this song months and months ago. It was a hit, you know? So he is a little ahead of the game, but unfortunately the world is so splintered in these days that it's even hard for him to reach. There's no consensus anymore on what matters. Everybody's in their own little place to listen, which is fine, but it's good to know that there's a guy like him who's sort of staying in tune with a much bigger picture as well, you know?
100%.
So, yeah.
Rob, it is dinner time for you. It's dinner time for us.
Dinner time it is. That's right. There's something going on.
I would love to have more conversations with you. This has been a blast. Thank you for
your... It's been an honor. Thank you.
I've been very excited. Like I know we first started trying to connect a few months ago, I think. But, you know, you sort of came out of the blue, and I was like, this is really cool. Thanks for reaching out. It's super cool.
Thank you for agreeing to come on our little show here. I really appreciate it. Greg and I love having these sorts of chats with musicians and artists about what's going on and their thoughts. And you couldn't have been more generous with your time.
You guys are a good team as well. So it's nice. You've got a good balance between your perspectives on how to approach things as well. So it's cool.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much. And we look forward to hearing some of your personal new music coming out, as well as some of the bands that you're working with.
And the book.
And the book. Absolutely. I will look forward to reading that book when it comes out, and all the best with the kids that you're working with.
Thank you.
Down in Queens. And again, thank you so much for your time, Rob. This has been a blast.
Thank you guys. I'll see you online. See you somewhere in the world.
Absolutely.
Sounds great.
Take care.
Thanks, Rob.
See you guys.